This is WILL AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking today with Kim Bobo, who is the Executive Director of Interfaith Worker Justice. Welcome, Kim.
Thank you, Steve. Good to be with you.
And we're talking to you from Chicago by phone.
Yes.
We have a good connection. Tell our listeners what Interfaith Worker Justice is as an organization.
Yeah. Interfaith Worker Justice is a national network of people of faith that engage and educate themselves and get involved in campaigns and issues that will improve conditions for workers with a special focus on low-wage workers. So we have a national network of groups around the country that both get involved in activism around work issues, and we have a network of now 25 worker centers that are kind of like drop-in centers for workers who are having problems in the workplace.
And how long have you been associated with Interfaith Worker Justice?
Well, I helped found Interfaith Worker Justice in 1996, so I've been there since the beginning.
Why was it needed?
Well, the religious community has been very active in hunger issues and homeless issues and generally on poverty issues, right? I mean, that's all of our faith, whether we're Christian, Jewish, Muslim, or, you know, any of the other traditions. You know, we believe that part of our faith is helping poor people. But how we've done that has primarily been through soup kitchens, shelters, a direct service kind of work, which is important and needs to continue. But everyone who's involved in working with a soup kitchens or shelter knows that people are actually in those situations because either they don't have jobs or they don't have jobs that pay enough. And so, you know, clearly we need to be involved in those questions of the quality of work as well in the society. And there really was no organization doing that from a faith perspective. And so it just seemed like, you know, there was a niche that we needed to fill. So I had done a lot of work for many years with Bread for the World and, you know, knew the hunger world very well. I also had done a fair amount of work on low-income housing and, again, knew that work, but knew that we needed to be engaged in jobs and making sure that workers are paid fairly so that they don't have to come to soup kitchens and shelters. So there really wasn't anything, and so I got a group of religious leaders together who knew the religious world and really cared about these issues, and we put an organization together.
Who were some of the first people who responded to you and others who were trying to get this group started to work on these kind of issues?
Mm-hmm. You know, some of our key leadership came from Chicago. I mean, you know, Chicago has a long history on some of these issues, and so Monsignor Jack Egan was an important figure in the work, as well as Monsignor George Higgins, Rabbi Robert Marks, again, long history in Chicago on civil rights issues, was a founder and a key force early on in the organization. Bishop DeWitt, a United Methodist bishop, was really involved in the work early on. We just had some really core leadership, and today we have about 40 religious leaders on our board that are from across the country. They are Christian, Jewish, Muslim, and, you know, we've just found a lot of support in the religious community on these issues, and, you know, the issue is just more important than ever given this economic crisis. We've, as a society, we've just got to figure out, you know, how do we both create jobs and how do we make sure that jobs that exist pay enough so that workers can raise their families in dignity, right? You do every survey that's been done recently on who's coming to soup kitchens, you know, it's not just people who don't have jobs. It's people who have jobs, but the jobs don't pay enough for them to be able to feed their families.
What do you do about that? As an organization, when you see a problem like that that's just endemic all over the country, where do you get your ideas of how to respond?
Well, you know, the challenge is for most of us in that we can't wave a wand and have it, the problems go away, right? So you have to kind of say, okay, at any given place, in any given moment, where are the opportunities to try and improve things? So we work in a variety of ways. So one way that we work is on public policies. So we've been very engaged in trying to get the minimum wage increased nationally. Or right now we're working to pass paid sick days, saying that, you know, that every worker ought to have a minimum number of paid sick days so that if you or your child gets sick, you can take off and not lose money, right? So we've been involved in public policy and are engaging the religious community in those public policy issues. Second thing we've done is we believe that workers should have the right to organize unions if they want them. Now, not everybody wants, nor does everybody need a union, but there are lots of workers that really do want to have a union, and unions in the society have done a fabulous job of raising wages and benefits. So, for example, in Houston, there were workers working, there were about 5,000 janitors in Houston who were working for the downtown business, downtown office buildings. They worked for the exact same companies as unionized janitors in Chicago because the buildings were owned by the same companies. And yet in Chicago, workers were making $12, $13 an hour plus health care benefits plus pension. In Houston, they were making minimum wage with no health care, no pension, and no sick days. And the only difference between the two cities, really, was that in Chicago, the janitors were unionized. In Houston, they were not. And so the workers organized a union and managed to raise wages significantly and get health care for the first time. So we really believe that for lots of workers, that they're going to be better served if they have unions, and that fundamentally, workers need to be able to decide whether or not they want to have unions without being terrified in the workplace. And unfortunately, Steve, right now, in the majority of workplaces, again, not all, but in the majority of workplaces, if workers try to organize a union, their employers just pull out all the stops to discourage them from having a union. So they hold meetings and they show videos and they fire a worker and they threaten to fire others. And, you know, it really is a very harsh environment. And so we support the rights of workers to have a union. Third thing we do is we run these worker centers. And the number one thing the worker centers do is they help workers who have not gotten paid actually get paid, or if they've not gotten paid for all their hours, to get paid for all their hours. We call this problem of workers not getting paid wage theft. Employers are flat out stealing wages from workers. And as we know from our biblical heritage, stealing is wrong, and stealing workers' wages is wrong. So we've really helped put the issue of wage theft on the national agenda, frankly. And we've done this both through the direct work. So the other day, there were a group of workers that came into our workers' center in Chicago. They work for a restaurant on Devon Avenue, not far from where I live and work. And these workers were getting paid $3.50 an hour. They worked 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. They weren't even getting minimum wage, let alone not getting paid overtime. The law is clear. This employer was flat out stealing from these workers. So they deserve to be paid according to the law. So we see this throughout the city and throughout the nation in terms of employers not paying workers. In fact, it's such a problem that last year I published a book called Wage Theft in America that really looks at this crisis. So a lot of these worker centers help these workers get their wages back. Sometimes we take delegations of religious leaders to meet with the employers and just say, look, what you're doing is not only morally wrong, but it's legally wrong, and you need to pay these workers. And you know what? The engagement of the religious community often gets these workers paid. But other times, we have to hook up those workers with attorneys, and sometimes they file cases on the workers' behalf. And other times, we take we help them file complaints with the State Department of Labor or city agencies. Some towns have city agencies as well. And so we're really trying to build some partnerships with the enforcement agencies. In fact, literally Monday, tomorrow, I have an appointment with the head of the Illinois State Department of Labor, trying to look at, you know, how can we partner better with your enforcement staff around the state to make sure that workers are paid. And then in about 10 cities right now around the country, our local chapters have introduced wage theft ordinances or laws into their city council or their county to try and strengthen enforcement at the local level. So we're just doing a lot around this whole enforcement area. So again, to reiterate, the three areas that we do the most work in, one is public policies, working on various bills. Second is supporting unions and the rights of workers to organize unions. And thirdly is really trying to strengthen enforcement to make sure workers are paid for all the work that they do.
We're talking with Kim Bobo, the director of the Interfaith Worker Justice Organization, by phone in Chicago. This is a live call-in program every Sunday night here on WILL AM 580. And listeners are encouraged to give us a call. If you have a comment or a question, call 333-9455 if it's a local call here in the Champaign-Urbana area. If you're listening farther away and it's long distance, even if you're listening on the internet, you may call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Kim, you've been director, you've been involved with the organization since it began in 1996. Mm-hmm. Tell us about some of your successes.
Well, you know, we have had lots and lots of successes, but let me just talk about a few of them. Just recently, we were involved with a group of workers. This is a worker center example. Again, I mentioned we had 25 of these worker centers around the country.
Mainly in big cities.
Interestingly, not. They are in a lot of big cities, but we also have one in Northwest Arkansas, in Western North Carolina, in Central Mississippi. Some of those have formed around poultry plants, uh-huh, trying to help poultry workers. But, you know, they're really not just in big cities, because the exploitation of workers happens not just in big cities, but in rural communities as well.
I interrupted you. We were talking about some of your successes.
That's right. So let me give you a perfect example. There was a group of workers that came in from a restaurant here in Chicago called Homemade Pizza. It's a chain of restaurants. There's, I don't know, 8 or 10 of them in the Chicagoland area. And these workers came in and they said, they had been upset because their employer was asking them to put stale pepperoni on the pizzas. And so some of the workers objected and wanted to, you know, use fresh pepperoni. And, you know, some employers don't like workers telling them what to do. And so the employer basically fired them on the spot and said, you know, if you don't like how we're doing business, then just get out. And for my trouble of having to fire you, I'm not going to give you your last paycheck. Well, this last paycheck problem is a very common problem for workers. So the workers found their way into our worker center, and they came in and said, you know, we're upset because we were fired, and he refused to give us our last paycheck. So we started looking at their pay stubs and quickly realized that none of the workers had been paid overtime, which they were supposed to be paid, and several of them also hadn't been paid minimum wage. So you have three problems there. You have the last paycheck problem, minimum wage violations, and overtime violations, right? So it's like, okay, you got a whole set of problems here. So the first thing we did was we called up the employer and said, look, you know, is there some mistake here, or, you know, just, you know, do you want to just settle this here immediately? And the employer was just ugly as could be, you know, said all sorts of nasty things to us. So we decided, you know, we just need to, you know, do a little action here. So we sent out a little email to folks and said, you know, if you're not doing anything at 6 o'clock on Tuesday night, then show up at one of these five locations of homemade pizza. So at each of the locations, I went to the one on Clark Street near where I live, and at each location there was a worker who had actually experienced this problem. There were some religious leaders, and there was just anybody else who wanted to show up. So at our location, we had about 15 folks, and like three of us were sent to go into the store, and then the other folks stood outside the store, and they handed out flyers that said, "Don't buy pizza topped with exploitation." Then we went into the place and said to the young men at the counter, we'd like you to call the owner of the chain and tell him that the workers should be paid for all their work and they should be repaid. And the young man said, you know, these folks are looking younger and younger to me, Steve. So the young man said, well, you know, I don't know what the number is. And I said, you know what, no problem. I got the number right here. And I pulled out my cell phone, dialed it for him, handed him the phone. And he, you know, spoke to the owner and said, you know, hey, I got these people in the restaurant. They won't go away. And what should I do? Anyway, so we had similar actions going on at five different locations around Chicago. And a half hour later, the employer called our worker center, and he was like, man, upset about it, but agreed that in a couple days' time he would meet with us and talk about this. So 2 days later he comes, he brings his attorney, and he's still fuming mad, but the attorney quickly realizes he's got to pay these workers, and 2 days later they paid them all the money that they were owed, not only the last paycheck, but the overtime, the minimum wage, they paid them. That's exactly what we're doing around the country. Our worker center in Chicago, I was just talking to them the other day, I think they helped workers recover about $800,000 in back pay that was owed them last year. And this is with a staff of like, you know, two people or something. And, you know, all of our worker centers are doing that. Another exciting thing, in Cincinnati, Ohio, now that, you know, you don't think of Cincinnati as the, you know, hotbed of radicalism or anything, they convinced the group there in Cincinnati, convinced the county to set up a task force in the county to look at misclassification of workers and what they could do to ensure that workers are classified properly. Now, let me just take a second and explain this misclassification problem, because it sounds like it's just a little minor paperwork problem. But again, it's another way that workers get cheated out of their wages. So if you are an employee, then your employer, your boss, pays payroll taxes, workers' compensation, unemployment insurance, and overtime. But if you are classified as an independent contractor, as a consultant, then your employer isn't going to pay all those things. Now, the truth is, sometimes people think, well, they can just call me whatever they want. That's not true. Most workers are actually employees. If your boss controls what you do, the boss controls the time that you work, the boss controls the terms, the boss controls the tools, then you're an employee, not an independent contractor. And yet we see many, many workers being misclassified, and it really cheats them out of wages. But it also cheats the public out of tax dollars, because it means those employers aren't paying into payroll taxes. They're not paying unemployment insurance. They're not paying workers' compensation. They're not paying into the public coffers on behalf of those workers. So if that worker gets injured or if that worker doesn't have a job, then when they turn for public services, that employer wouldn't have paid for his or her fair share of those. So this misclassification is a huge problem in the society right now. And so in Cincinnati, our group managed to get them to set up a whole task force to look at what the county could do to deal with this misclassification problem. So again, we're doing that kind of thing around the country right now. It's very exciting.
We just heard a report on All Things Considered, about the census jobs that are around the country that are part-time. There are many part-time jobs. Are there problems with those workers?
Well, you know, with the census jobs, I suspect that they will be pretty good jobs for most workers and certainly will give a boost to the economy. But the whole issue of part-time work certainly is one of the challenges for society, in that you find employers all over the place that have been pretty intentional about keeping people at part-time levels, which means that they're not eligible for benefits, right? If benefits mean, you know, if you have to work 30 hours to be full-time to get some sort of health care benefits, then you find employers working folks 29 hours so that they don't get those benefits. And while that might be a smart bottom-line move for a particular employer, it's a terrible bottom-line move for workers and their families. And so as a society, I think we've really got to look at, you know, how do we encourage employers to pay people decent wages? And I think clearly a real question is when public dollars are used and when government subsidies are given to companies, how can we make sure that the jobs that are provided through those dollars actually pay people decent wages? And that we know we can work on as a society. I think the thing that no one really has the answers for right now is how do we create enough jobs for everybody who needs to and wants to work in the society. And in this time of economic crisis, the issues are very front and center for us. But frankly, the issues were pretty significant even before this current economic crisis.
To introduce our guest again, for folks who may have tuned in a little bit later for Keeping the Faith this afternoon, Kim Bobo is our guest. She's the director of the National Network of the Interfaith Worker Justice Organization that's headquartered in Chicago. It deals with public policy and support for the rights of workers to unionize and has set up worker centers at various places around the country. If you have questions or comments, do give us a call. We're eager to have the conversation be as wide as possible. 333-9455 in the Champaign-Urbana area where the program originates. Otherwise, 1-800-222-9455. And incidentally, if you've missed part of this program or want to hear other programs as part of the Keeping the Faith series, go to our website, will.illinois.edu. Go to AM when you're offered AM, FM, or TV. And under AM, you can search for the Keeping the Faith programs. This program will be archived there at that location online within about a week where all our former programs for the last several years can be found. That's will.illinois.edu. And we have a caller on line one in Champaign. Yes, you have a comment or question for Kim Bobo?
Yeah, I've been working for the census, so I can speak to that that's problematic, and there are some problems. On the whole, it's a pretty good employer, and they pay pretty much at or above the going rate for the area. How much you're paid depends on where you live. So, for instance, an enumerator in this area makes $12.50, and up in Lake County they make $17.50 or $18.50, which I don't have a problem with that. I think that's fair. But what they do for, now I'm a field worker, and so I'm paid from the time I leave my house to go out in the field or for working at home, which that's cool with me. People who work in the office are paid from the time they get to the office. So I don't really have a problem with me being part-time. I have a problem with the way they do it, like the clerks that work in the offices, the local offices. They're appointed for 2 months at a time, and so they never get any benefits, even though they might work 6 months or 9 months. Now the administrators in the local offices, they're appointed for like a 1 or 2 year period or whatever, so they get some benefits. So I have a problem with how they're doing with clerks in the offices who might work for a whole year. And then the other thing was when I was working in the spring, I was working out of the out of an office in southern Illinois, and we're not allowed to, okay, officially you're allowed 5 hours of overtime and a week of training, but that office did not allow any overtime, and I was giving a training an hour away from here, and they made me commute there. They wouldn't let me stay in a hotel, although technically I was, it was over the limit of where you should be able to stay in a hotel. It was over 50 miles. And so in effect, my commuting time was a gift to the Census Bureau because I worked my whole 40 hours doing the training, and then the commuting was on top of that. So there are some problems. Now, it depends what office. Not every office does it that way. So so I just wanted to make those comments.
Share your information. Well, thank you very much. We appreciate the call. Kim, any response?
No, I mean, I think she's right. Those are concerns, right? I think one of the challenges that we have in the society right now is people are overall so desperate for work, right, that it doesn't put much pressure on employers, whether it's the government or the private sector, to try to improve benefits and make working conditions better because people feel like they can get away with things right now. So, you know, it is very difficult. And it, you know, I talk to workers all the time who, you know, they'll say to me, you know I ought to be getting overtime. I work 50 hours a week, and, you know, I know that from 40 to 50 hours, I ought to be paid overtime for those hours, but, you know, hey, at least I got a job, right? Well, okay. You know, I understand that sentiment exactly, right? People are, you know, anxious to hold on to whatever, but, you know, we can't allow the economy to enable unethical employers to treat people poorly.
Do private employers in general treat people better than government?
You know, I think that's a hard thing to say. I would say that the government actually does a much better job following the laws around employment. You know, they have built-in systems. It's much easier for workers to organize unions in most public sector areas. And so there is much more accountability on basically following the law. You know, it is a huge problem for low-wage workers in terms of employers following the law. There was recently a survey that was that came out in right before Labor Day 2009, so the end of August 2009, that surveyed over 5,000 low-wage workers in New York, Chicago, and L.A. So these are workers that primarily make $10 an hour or less. What it found was that 26% of workers were not paid the minimum wage, and 76% weren't paid overtime as required. For those workers who worked overtime, 76% were not paid overtime. I mean, that's just rampant violation in the private sector of the core labor standards, right? If you assume that sort of the most basic labor laws are minimum wage and overtime, right, that's pretty basic, that you've got 26% and 76% respectively violating those laws in low-wage worker sectors. And these three cities where the surveys were conducted, New York, Chicago, and L.A., these are all cities that have some of the best enforcement agencies in the nation. So we're not talking about what happens in Mississippi or Alabama, where they have three enforcement staff for the entire state, or Florida, where in the state legislature's wisdom, they voted out even having a state enforcement agency. So they don't even have any enforcement agency at all. So if it's that bad in New York, Chicago, and L.A., it's probably much worse in many areas that don't have enforcement agency.
Kim, we have another caller waiting, this one on line one also from Urbana. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest Kim Bobo from Interfaith Worker Justice. Go ahead.
Hi, this is very interesting. I had a situation about 16 or 17 years ago, and it wasn't a low-wage type of job. It was a more of a professional position, but where we realized we weren't getting paid overtime when we were supposed to, and another person was misclassified, probably on purpose. I'm sure it was on purpose, because when she tried to fix it, it got caught pretty bad. And the thing is, at the time, how long did you say this organization's been going?
Since 1996.
Oh, see, that was a little bit after. Oh, we could have really used it, because I want to say I'm really endorsing this, because at the time that this happened to us, we managed to get the overtime thing settled faster just because we just fussed so much and gave up. But the person who was misclassified, it took her months, and she kept calling. She kept calling the state, whatever department it is that does that, and she just stuck with it. And finally, you know, he gave up because she just would not let go of it. And the state, the guy at the state, talked to him and stuff. And finally, she got what she was supposed to have. But you know, there wasn't any place that we could find to turn to that we could really get a good. To do what you're doing, the kind of service you're doing. So I just wanted to, A, tell you I think this is wonderful, and B, I'm kind of just appalled to think that our society, I don't know how to put this, in terms of faith, you know, the show is about faith, and the lack of faith, the lack of honesty, the lack of integrity that is just rampant in this society that shows up in the little things that everyday people do is pretty sad.
Well, you know, I, as a kid, I grew up with, you know, the Ten Commandments, right? And one of them was, thou shalt not steal, right? And, you know, if you think about it, you know, if a worker steals from his or her employer, you know, that worker's, you know, going to get fired, right? They're going to get fired. They might go to jail. I mean, you know, there's serious consequences. But what we're seeing right now is that if an employer steals wages from workers, which, you know, for a low-wage worker, well, for any worker, it means, you know, there's consequences for the family, right? I mean, this is really stealing from the mouths of babes, right? So when employers steal, there's seldom consequences. And you know, the worst thing that happens is that the employer will have to pay the workers back. Well, obviously they should. But what we find sometimes is, in fact, what we find often is that the employer will only pay back a part of what they should have paid, right? So, in fact, it is really stealing from the workers. I'm curious on your situation where you got your employer to pay overtime, did the employer give you back wages for what you were owed?
We've lost our connection with our guest, but perhaps she'll call back. And in the meantime, we're about halfway through our program, and I need to say a few things, Kim.
Okay.
Don't go away.
I'm not going anywhere.
When we get back, I'd like to hear about how you got to this position and the work you did before. You mentioned Bread for the World and working in low-income housing. But first of all, let me say you are listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM, and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana, and perhaps listening online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these programs. Next week, we'll be having a archive program on Martin Luther King weekend. Then January 31st, January 24th, our guest will be Imani Bazell, and she'll be interviewed by Don Nolan, and the topic will be talking about the Unit 4 consent decree here in the school system in Champaign-Urbana going forward from that. I'll be recovering from a bit of surgery I need to have on January 21st, so Don Nolan very kindly is helping out on the 24th. I'm having a right knee replaced, so we'll see how long that takes me to before I get back on the air. Our guest for the 31st, and I hope to be back for that, is Paul Nitter from New York City, from the Union Theological Seminary faculty, and his recent book on how he feels he needs to be a Buddhist in order to be a good Christian. That'll be January 31st. February 7th, our guest is James S. Wolfe from Indianapolis on his practicing seven different religions at once. Paul Wolfe, a professor from University of Indianapolis, February 7th will be our guest. So some of the things to look forward to here on Keeping the Faith. I want to thank our technical director, as always, Cal Kroa, for answering the phones and dealing with our all the technical matters that keep these programs coming for us. We do have another caller waiting on line one, so let's go there. Yes, you're on the air with Kim Bobo from Interfaith Worker Justice. I might say that that's spelled B-O-B-O, Kim Bobo. Yes, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, I was on before, and then you asked me a question, and somehow I'd gotten cut off, and I couldn't get
your back. Good.
I called back. But now that you said that, I started thinking back, and what I remember is I think I got some overtime. I can't remember for sure, but I remember that the other guy that worked there had been there much longer than me, and the huge amount of overtime that he had done that he didn't get paid for as overtime, he got paid straight time, but not overtime, mm-hmm. had happened 2 years, more than 2 years previous to this. And the law at the time said only the last 2 years could be rectified or counted or something. I don't know exactly.
It still says that unless it can be proved as willful.
Mm-hmm. So possibly that he could have been compensated if there had been a way to, like I said, I wish you guys had been there. But anyway, so again, I think this is wonderful.
Great. Well, thanks for calling back.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. Kim, let's go ahead and find out a little bit more about your background. Tell us, what was your first employment situation personally?
Oh, I think my first employment, I was 14 years old. I was hired as an aide at a nursing home. I started working quite young. I don't really remember any of the details on pay. You know, whatever it was, it seemed like a lot for a 14-year-old.
Where was that? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Any particular religious tradition?
I grew up in the Church of Christ.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Sort of an evangelical tradition. And in fact, I really attribute my just core commitment to justice to the upbringing I had in my church, which was really reading the scriptures, studying the scriptures, and really taking to heart what it said. And, you know, it's always a mystery to me how anyone can read the scriptures and not have such a clear sense of the scriptures' priority for justice and for care for the poor. Because it's just in, you know, it's in every book of the Bible, right? So, again, that teaching and upbringing really stayed in my spirit, and I certainly attribute why I do the work I do today because of that sort of evangelical church upbringing.
Where'd you go to school?
I started at a church school in Nashville, Tennessee, called David Lipscomb, and then I transferred to Barnard College in New York City.
That was a big change.
That was a big change, that's right. There's a whole story there, but... And I was a religion major at Barnard, and that was a wonderful experience for me. And I don't know if you know, but Barnard is right up the street from Union Seminary, and so I was able to take some classes at Union Seminary, including a class on liberation theology from Gustavo Gutierrez.
Wow.
And anyway, it was just a great experience. And then eventually I got my master's in economics from the New School for Social Research, also in New York. But when I was in New York, I managed to get a housing situation with this woman who was a social justice activist and needed somebody to walk her dog in exchange for free housing. And I'm like, okay, that works for me in New York City, right?
Oh, yeah.
So I lived with this woman named Marie Runyon, and she just had spent her whole career as an organizer. And I didn't even know such a thing existed, right? And so, you know, she took me out on housing demonstrations and this kind of thing and that kind of thing. And it just kind of opened up this whole new world for me of, oh, my, there's some ways to address problems in systematic ways, because I think I'd always wanted to be a social worker or something, right? I wanted to help people. But, you know, it just seemed like through this organizing, you could help people in bigger ways than doing social service work. And then when I was in college, it was at the time when Bread for the World was just getting started. Bread for the World was founded in 1974. And I joined in 1975 as just a member and thought, oh, this is really great. And then I started doing some organizing work on my campus on hunger issues. And, you know, when I graduated from college, I thought Bread for the World was just the best thing. And so I went to Bread for the World and I said, look, is there anything, any jobs you got? I'll do anything, just absolutely any job you have. And so I got on first as working on a short-term 3-month project, and then I got hired as an organizer, and then I became director of organizing. And I spent the first 10 years of my sort of serious professional career on staff of Bread for the World. And I, both in my early years and then directing a whole department of organizers, built a network of volunteer Bread for the World chapters around the country. And
a lot more people realize that organizing can be a career now that we have a former community organizer as president.
Isn't that right? He's really given some real prestige to the field. So I worked at Bread for the World for 10 years, and, you know, my experience was just wonderful in terms of the religious community working on public policies around hunger. You know, people understood that we can't just do shelters. They wanted to do public policies, and so Bread for the World was just very effective. And again, I just saw the best side of the religious community, people wanting to help and wanting to be involved. So then I got hired to work for the Midwest Academy in Chicago, which is a training center for community organizers. So my husband and I, who I'd met at Bread for the World, flew out to or came out to Chicago, and I started working for the Midwest Academy. And, you know, I was kind of called the – I was, like, considered the church lady, right? I was the one that was always trying to connect whatever it was with the religious community. And the Academy, the Midwest Academy, had done a lot of work with labor unions over the years. And, frankly, I had not had that much experience with labor unions. And so I started doing some work with labor unions. And on every campaign, I would say, well, what's the religious community doing? And, you know, at the time, this is mid-'80s and early 90s, people would look at me like I had kind of dropped off of another planet. And they'd say, like, what do you mean the religious community and labor? I'd say, well, you know, they care about poverty. They care about poor people. Of course they want to be involved in this. And union leaders were like, okay, sure, lady. And then the Pittston coal miners strike, which occurred 1989-1990, I heard Mr. Trumka, who was at the time the president of the mine workers, and he's now actually the president of the AFL-CIO, I heard him talking about their strike with the Pittston coal miners. And this was a righteous strike, if ever there was one. These miners, the company had decided to arbitrarily cut off health care benefits for pensioners, right? And if you've worked in the mines for 30 years, you've destroyed your health, right? That's what happens in the mines. And so health care for pensioners is just essential. And this company just arbitrarily decided to cut off health care for pensioners. And
there are no laws that keep companies from doing that?
Well, there are at this point,
no.
But at
okay.
That point there weren't. And so the existing miners decided they would go out on strike to try to protect health care for pensioners. So, again, what a righteous effort, right, to be striking not for your own self and family, but for retirees, right? I mean, it was very impressive. And I was like, whoa, this is great. The religious community would want to help on this. And again, people thought, well, what could the religious community do? And I said, well, I'm sure we could do something. And so I volunteered to put together a national religious support committee for this strike. And so I started by calling all the denominations, and I said, you know, I'd like to talk to your labor staff person. Well, it was a very short conversation because none of the denominations had any staff people assigned to labor issues. They had hunger staff, they had homeless staff, they had housing staff, but none of them had anybody assigned working on labor, nor did anybody have anybody working on economic justice or workers or anything in that arena. Well, okay, I said, fine, let's just get the hunger people and the housing people, let's get them involved because, you know, they get the connections. So we managed to get lots of folks around the country. We organized meetings with the board members. We organized a 2,000-person religious rally in Southwest Virginia. Anyway, we just did a lot of things. And, you know, on any strike like the Pittston strike, you never quite know what turns the tide in terms of them settling the strike. But most people thought that the religious engagement played a role in the settlement of that strike. So after that, you know, labor folks were saying to me, whoa, Kim, how did you do that? Like, you know, I had some special genes or something. And I was like, well, you know, I just asked people. It really wasn't that difficult because people of faith want to help. But they had been, the faith community and the labor community had really not been working together on issues that they shared, right, issues of concerns for people. So I was like, well, maybe I could do something in Chicago. I live in Chicago. So in 1991, I put together a religious group to work on labor issues here in Chicago. And so we started to support workers who were organizing unions, workers there who were having problems. We worked on the living wage bill in the Chicago area. And so I worked as a volunteer for 4 or 5 years and just built a group of religious leaders in the Chicagoland area supporting low-wage workers and labor issues. And then in the mid-90s, in 1996, I just decided that this work on labor stuff was some of the most important work I was doing. And so I cut back my work with the academy to half-time so I could spend the other half-time trying to start interfaith worker justice. So that's what I did. So I volunteered for the first 6 months of the organization trying to see if we could build an organization. And now we have 50 local affiliates around the country and 25 worker centers as part of this national network.
We're down to our last 10 minutes of the program. Let me give the phone numbers again for listeners who'd like to call in and make a comment or ask a question to our guest, Kim Bobo. If you're listening online, and we have this program, of course, can be heard live anywhere in the world at will.illinois.edu. If you're listening online and you're in the continental U.S., you may use an 800 number, toll-free, 222-9455. That's 222-WILL. If it's a local call, if you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, do use 333-9455 to get access to several local lines. Kim, let's talk a little bit about universities, since we're headquartered here at the University
mm-hmm,
of Illinois.
Absolutely.
And I know my connection, my learning about interfaith worker justice came when some graduate students here were organizing to form a union because they felt that they were not being heard by the administration in terms of their working conditions and hours and wages and so forth. And the graduate employee organization got formed partly with the help of local clergy, religious leaders from different faiths who did support their effort to unionize.
I remember the fine work you did.
Well, I was involved in that committee for a while, and they were interesting times, but tell us, have you had much experience with other universities as graduate students, faculty, employees at universities try to organize?
We've been involved with a lot of campus efforts, actually. And it tends to be two or three different groups of workers organized. Increasingly, we are seeing these grad students who are really taken advantage of in many campuses. So grad students are organizing all over the nation. We also see in past decades, the food services were run by the universities, right? They were staff of the universities. But in recent years, almost all the food services have been contracted out to companies like Aramark or Sodexo. And these companies are not known for their great treatment of workers. And consequently, workers are trying to fight back and improve conditions. And so workers are organizing at Sodexo, at Aramark, at sort of all the major food chains that have the contracts with universities. And clearly, universities can ensure that those companies recognize those workers' rights to organize. And so food service is a big deal around universities for organizing. Then we have the janitors and the groundspeople. And again, these workers often are paid salaries that you can't raise a family on. And that happens both when the jobs are contracted as well as when they're direct hires of the university. Although I have to tell you, in my recent experience, most of these janitorial jobs have been contracted out. And they've been contracted out solely to lower the amount that the university pays. Well, you know, if you're paying $20 an hour and you contract it out at $10 an hour, you can bet that the workers only paid $7 or $8 an hour, right? So janitors and grounds folks is really the other place where workers are organizing. And then you do have some campuses where the students or the faculty have said, you know what, we need to have a living wage standard for our university. And so it's really not the drive doesn't come directly from the workers, but either the students or the faculty or some combination really push the institution to say, you know, what does it mean to have a job here at our university, and how can we set a living wage standard for all workers? And then they usually have a process that goes on for 6 months or a year, and they work through what are some core standards for the university in terms of wages and benefits.
Kim, with your organization's concern for workers and their rights to have unions, do you also have sympathy for universities that are having real trouble with getting money from the state, and the fact that we have, you know, such a low general tax rate in the state of Illinois, and when the administrations really do seem to be suffering in terms of having funds to work with?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, you can't take blood from a turnip, right? I mean, if there's not money, you can't get it, right? And that's true in a lot of states where they've been, frankly, have not looked at what's a fair income tax in the state, and consequently both public universities and key social services for low-income people are really being cut to the bone. And in those situations, it's very difficult, whether you have a union or not, to get decent wages to pay workers. You know, so we do as a society have to look at, you know, how do we tax ourselves so that we can pay for the services that our citizens need. Listen, Steve, one thing I do want to mention before, I don't want to make sure we don't lose all of our time here, is Interfaith Worker Justice, one of the things we've really tried to do is create lots of resources for people for lifting up these issues in the lives of their congregation. And so I want to give you the website. It is IWJ.org. It stands for Interfaith Worker Justice, IWJ.org. You can go there. You can sign up to get our e-alerts, which will tell you about issues that are going on and how you can help. We also will send you notices about new resources. So, for example, we've just sent out a bunch of resources for congregations on Martin Luther King resources so that you can use them for your King, Dr. King services that you might do next Sunday or the following Monday. We will have resources for St. Joseph the Worker Day. We always have a big program all around Labor Day, of course, where we have resources for Christian, Jewish, and Muslim congregations, and we organize programs to get labor speakers in congregations.
And so, all of that can be found at IWJ.org.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right.
And how is your organization supported financially?
We ask for individual contributions from folks, so you can also give online if you want to give when you go to the website. We get some support from denominations and congregations, you know, so the Presbyterian Hunger Program gives us money and, you know, the Lutheran Hunger Program, so we get some money from the denominations. We get some money from unions. We get money from foundations, and we are also working to get money from lawsuits that are where there's extra money from what's called Cypre awards from lawsuits. So if you're a lawyer and have one of these Cypre awards, make sure you write in IWJ.
How large is your staff?
I have about 18 staff between some are part-time and some full-time in Chicago. And then there are in the 50 affiliates around the country, they range everywhere from complete volunteer operations to four or five staff in some of those. Now, those aren't, I don't raise the money for all of those. A lot of that money is raised locally, but.
We're getting close to our end time. Do you have any last words about the situation for labor, particularly in the state of Illinois?
Well, Illinois faces the same problems as most of the rest of the nation in that, one, we've got a huge crisis around workers not having jobs, so we've got to create jobs and preserve jobs. But we also have a crisis in terms of workers not getting paid for all the work that they do. And so we, all of us, have got to do what we can to make sure that workers get paid fairly. And again, this is not just a problem for somebody else. It's a problem for each one of us. So if you find that your son or daughter or cousin or brother is not getting paid what they ought to be paid, then you help them stand up and make sure they get paid. When you go to hire somebody to cut your grass, ask how that worker is going to get paid, because it matters. When you tip at a restaurant, leave your tip in cash, because 10% of tipped workers, where the tip goes on a credit card, they never see that tip. So when you go to a restaurant, pay in cash.
We're going to have to stop. But
okay,
stop. That's a good place, a good reminder for all of us. We've been talking with Kim Bobo, who's the Executive Director of Interfaith Worker Justice. You can learn more about that at IWJ.org. And Kim is the author of a book that came out last year, Wage Theft in America. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs here on WILL. Every evening from 5 to 6 Central Time, you may listen to programs here. It's a live call-in show. We're happy to have you join the conversation. Thank you for those who called in today. And thanks to our engineer, Kyle Kroah. Next week, we'll have an archive program over Martin Luther King Weekend. The following week, Imani Bazell will be one of our guests, hosted by Don Nolan as I recover from a planned surgery, talking about the Champaign Unit 4 consent decree and what's going to be happening in the future. Paul Nitter from the Union Seminary in New York will be our guest on January 31st, talking about being a Buddhist, helping him be a Christian. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, this is Julie Pride, Administrator of the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District. When you take a flu shot and an H1N1 shot, you're not just protecting yourself, you are helping to protect others. Infants under 6 months of age cannot be vaccinated. They need you to provide community immunity. The vaccine does not work as well in elderly persons. They need you to provide community immunity. And persons with compromised immune systems do not get the full protection from the vaccine. They need you to provide community immunity. Join the 45,000 others in Champaign County who have already been vaccinated. For more information, visit willconnect.org/health and click on the map to your right to find a health department near you. Or you can call my office for assistance at 217-